Bonsoir, mesdames et messieurs. Je m'appelle Colleen Shepherd. Je suis la directrice du Centre sur les droits de la personne et le pluralisme juridique. And tonight, I am going to be moderating this event, which was organized by the Aboriginal Law Students Association in collaboration with the SEED office and other partners at McGill and beyond. To begin this evening's event, I want to welcome Elder Sonny Diabo from Ganawage, who's going to do a formal traditional opening for our this evening. So please join me in welcoming.
It's going to be all in fun and games. In the old days, the priests used to do this. By the time we woke up in the morning, all the natives were gone. It's time to leave. But again, it's a pleasure to be here, to be invited. And in our ways, my grandmother told me just to come and listen to this presentation. Because in our community, in Ganawage, it's not, a lot of people don't know about this Niagara Treaty. I had to do a quick 5-minute history lesson yesterday. So just to come here, but I was told, don't say nothing, just listen. And if they have any documents that you can bring back, bring it home. And then I have to sit with my people and explain to them about what they're going to talk about. It's something that I guess, in our ways, I was told that I think we better start learning treaties that have been signed in the past. Because I think we get caught up with too many things and we forget about what our issues are all about. So I'm here to learn as much as I can, as well as all of you. And I welcome all of you. In our ways, I welcome all of you and ask the Great Spirit for his strength and guidance here today. Because I know this is a big thing. I never knew, they said it's big, but I didn't know how big it was. So it's like, I'm interested to learn. As elders, if you think we know everything, no, we don't. Sometimes we forget things, even though I had teachers that taught me many, many things. But before I go on, I would like to welcome my brothers from out west, Jinawa, at the Watsotos, where the sun sets, and to come here and to do a presentation. And it's an honor to welcome them to Montreal, a suburb of Ganawage. We always have to say that. My elders always said, whenever you speak, always say to welcome everybody to Montreal, a suburb of Ganawage. Because our ancestors were here, right on this area. And just a few weeks back, they said they found some bodies just up here that were buried. It's many, many years ago. And they unearthed four skeletons, and they don't know of what nation they are. They think that they are Iroquois, but we'll see what happens when they do the autopsy and check it all out. So I guess this is where our ancestors lived. And they say that the Iroquois of the St. Lawrence that were no longer here, that's all they moved was to Oka, Anasadaga. That's all they moved was just 40 minutes away from here, or 35 minutes by car. And they inhabited all this area right here. But there was also Algonquins, but they were more further up, I guess. It's a lot of history lessons that you have to learn in this. I wish I should have went to school and do anthropology to learn all of this. But I guess in my ways, my path was already set not to go to college or university, because there was other plans made for me to stand up and do an address to all of you here. And I welcome all of you. And I hope a lot of you are learning what's going to happen here today. I know I will, because I got to teach my children and my grandchildren and great-grandchildren. But my name is Alex Sanidaba. I am from Ganawage, just 15 kilometers south of here. I am of the Ganyagahaga Nation, people of the Flint, better known as Mohawks. And this is a pleasure to come here, Faculty of Law. This is my third I did the welcoming of law students for 2 years in a row, but I couldn't come this year because of other commitments. And my granddaughter wanted to come here because last year I brought her. And the first time they ever allowed smudging in this building. And my granddaughter did all the smudging. So she asked me again, Bubba, when are we going back to that building? I said, well, when the time comes. I'm trying to teach her because she's in high school, to teach her what it's like to go into college or university and how to adapt to it. Because as Native people, sometimes we just don't want to stay in these places. We come to school, and graduate all the ones that graduated. And it's always a pleasure. As some of you don't know, I am the elder for McGill, for the First Nations, Inuit, and Métis students that come into McGill. And this is my third year, and I've enjoyed 3 years. I've enjoyed it a lot. And this is an experiment that's been done where an elder from a community close by that was asked to represent all the First Nations that come here. But it's not only First Nations, it's all of you. To welcome you into McGill University. And I encourage you to continue your studies, especially you as if you're going to be law students. We as Natives always need lawyers, but there's always issues that come about, and we need you to assist us and help us improve or make better our lives because of everything that goes around and everything that happens. I think you'll see this in this presentation. But I told them I would do it in 5 minutes, so I'll give myself 5 minutes. And I wish you all a very good evening. And I'll make friends with a lot of you. Maybe some of you don't know me, but hopefully by the time I leave here, some of you will know who I am. Some of you probably see me at the First People's House, or you see me walking around. And I make a suggestion to all of you. Friday, I want to see you at the field over here for the powwow, the annual powwow. Maybe we'll have a dance together, who knows? Because I'll be the elder there, and I am a performer and a dancer, so I hope to see you all on Friday. Thank you. Have a good evening. Yawakua.
Thank you very much. And I want to acknowledge that we are on Mohawk territory and to thank the Mohawk people for sharing their territory with us. So, as I mentioned earlier, the event for this evening's events was conceptualized and organized by the Aboriginal Law Students Association predominantly. And I'd like to acknowledge and thank Molly Churchill, who's to my right here, in particular for her work in making this event happen on this first day of McGill Indigenous Awareness Week, which, as I mentioned earlier, is an initiative of the SEED Social Equity and Diversity Education Office. Molly will introduce our two speakers in a moment, and then after they each speak, for about half an hour each, we'll have some time for questions. Before Molly introduces our two speakers, however, I'd like to just take a moment to thank some of the sponsors for this event. We received financial support from the law faculty and also from two Montreal law firms who do extensive work on the rights of Indigenous peoples, Dion Schultz, and Hutchins Legal Incorporated. And some of our graduates are now lawyers with those firms, and we're very thankful for their financial support. So without further ado, I'd like to turn the floor over to Molly Churchill from the Aboriginal Law Students Association to introduce our two speakers.
Thank you all for coming, and it's really my honor to be able to introduce our speakers for tonight. I'm going to introduce them both at the beginning so that we don't have as many, less interesting speakers interrupting in between. So first, on the man on my far left, so I guess your right, is Alan O.G. Corbiar of the B'nai Dodum Rufford Bruce Clan. He's an Anishinaabe from Michigan First Nation on Manitoulin Island. He was educated on the reserve and then attended the University of Toronto for a Bachelor of Science. He then entered York University and earned his Master's of Environmental Studies. During his Master's, he focused on Anishinaabe narrative and Anishinaabe language revitalization. For 5 years, he served as the executive director at the Ojibwe Cultural Foundation in Michigan, and it's a position which also encompassed the role of curator and historian. During his time there, he studied wampum belts and the Anishinaabe perspective on their meaning. He's currently the Anishinaabemowin Revitalization Program Coordinator at Lakeview School in Michigan First Nation. So I'm really happy that, thankful that he's traveled all this way to share his knowledge on the wampum with us. Our second speaker for the evening is Aaron Mills. He's a Bear Clan Anishinaabe from Kuchiching First Nation, Treaty 3 Territory, and from North Bay, Ontario, Robinson-Huron Treaty Territory. In 2010, Aaron obtained a JD from the University of Toronto, where he was editor-in-chief of the Indigenous Law Journal and sat on the board of directors of Aboriginal Legal Services of Toronto. In 2011, he completed articles at Olthias Clear Townshend LLP, where he worked on an Aboriginal title file, a treaty rights file, myriad duty to consult files, assertions of Indigenous law, and the protection of a sacred Anishinaabe site. Aaron earned an LLM at Yale Law School as a Fulbright Scholar in 2012. He is currently a Trudeau Foundation Scholar, a Vanier Canada Scholar, and a doctoral student at the University of Victoria's Law and Society Program. He also sits on the board of directors of the Indigenous Bar Association. So thank you both for coming, and I'm going to turn the floor over to Alan Corbiere.
Nana Bojo. Myself, I'm from Manitoulin Island, and the reserve I'm from is called Mchiging. And my clan is the Rough Gross, Bine, we say. So I tried to learn to speak our language. My parents spoke Ojibwe every day, but then they turned to me and my siblings and talk in English. So we lost us kids, we never picked it up. So this whole thing that I've been trying to do for myself, I listened to one old man, and I also read of this as well, that they said that many things would be left alongside the road, meaning us Anishinaabe people, and this would apply, I guess, to the Haudenosaunee and the Cree, that all along the way in our interaction through life with non-native people, who we call Wemtagosh, the Frenchmen, as well as the Jaganash, the Englishmen, that sometimes something would be left alongside the trail, and that what we're going to try and do is pick it back up, that it becomes our duty to pick this stuff back up. So I never blamed my parents for me not picking up the language. But when I was, I finally met my wife, and my wife and I, we had conceived a child, and that child, when she was coming, that's what I decided. All my ancestors spoke my language, and it stops with me. So I'm going to try and do something to pick it up and then pass that on, like what our elder here said, that he's got a responsibility to keep learning. Even though he's an elder, he's still learning, and he's going to take that back so that his children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren know a bit more. So it's the same with me. I was looking for a lot of different things, a lot of different teachings everywhere, and I was learning to speak Ojibwe, and I knew how to say table, water, cup, teapot, and all this kind of stuff. But I said, I wanted to learn our story. I wanted to learn our language. And I wanted to be able to tell our story in our language, our history, as well as what they call our legends. But what I'm going to tell you about here is one day, I'm actually trained in environmental science and environmental studies. That was what my degree was in. But I did it on the Anishinaabe narrative and language revitalization, as well as looking at it as a communal knowledge revitalization. So one day I found in the archives a letter written in Ojibwe. And the first words of the letter said, "We migaz ya," I should say. that I still know how you spoke to my ancestors when you bid them to go to war. So that's what it said in Ojibwe. Then the next line said, Nui kanash kwa mabe wa bimidabit kichigamima wang. I will chase away anybody who comes to your great lake. O gana de bendanga de benoji madakimawe dewayanik. Kaanak. This is what you had said to us, that you told us that our children will own that land. He told us this at Niagara. So that's what I saw in the letter, and I read it, and I didn't really understand what it meant. What's this letter talking about? Because it doesn't actually say treaty, and it doesn't say wampum belt. And then the next thing it said in there, it says, Nandawabandangadabanoji mobimadzwen wenjamok set gizis. In an avian galta gizik, Nandawabandanaway de wenjamok set. So they said, as you look around all the heaven, look where the sun rises for the support and the livelihood of your children. And there you will see, and this is the important part, there is where you will see a sun rising red. And it says, Divishko eje maskokanyaya, the same as the color of my coat. And when you see that sun rising red, and you see, you'll be reminded of all these promises that were made at that time. And they said, Nalgesh biming, and as that sun gets higher, they said, all the earth will be touched by its rays. And then they said, again, higher yet that sun will rise. And in all different places, flowers will bloom. And they said, "Me, this is the refrain of this speech. That is the image of the life of your children, if you take this belt." So, of course, at that time, we were embroiled in a war. In 1763, Bejik, one of the chiefs named Pontiac, and then another, a Seneca chief, Casueto, were the ones that stood up and took a stand against the British, because the British thought they had defeated us as the Anishinaabe people, the Western Confederacy, but they did not. So we told them that you haven't conquered us, you conquered the French, but you have to come to our country and bring us presents. And that's what they had told us at that time, that no, we're not going to give you presents. And it was under the order of Lord Jeffrey Amherst, who said, no, once a people have been conquered, you don't curry their favor with presents and bribe them of their good for their good behavior. They were conquered and will withdraw these presents. So that's when Pontiac and Gasueto formed a confederacy and bound all the different nations to take these different forts. So we forced them back to recognize who they were dealing with. And we forced them that this was actually a thing what we call, nowadays what you call nation-to-nation relationship. But in this belt, you'll see this belt around, and you'll see people, or you may hear people, talk about it, that they'll say it represents unity. And it represents that one is a Jaganash, meaning the British, and the other is an Anishinaabe holding hands, the red man and the white man holding hands. And this is called the Civil Covenant Chain Wampum Belt. And of course, it was delivered in 1764 at Niagara. But the theory actually is, but I haven't gotten the firm proof, is that two of these belts were given at that time. One for the Western Confederacy, and the other to the Eastern Confederacy. So this one, you see here, this is the presents that were, this is the pledge of the presents. And here are 24 nations that were assembled at Niagara at that time. 12 representing the Western Confederacy and 12 representing the Eastern Confederacy. So what the theory was is that the other belt, the second set of belts were kept at Conestoga. And the other ones were entrusted to the Odawa people at Michilimackinac, and then eventually those Odawa people moved to Manitoulin Island, where I'm from. And the actual speech I refer to and quote was written on the reserve that I'm from on June 27, 1862, 98 years after the delivery of this. So what they had actually said at that time when they asked us for peace, they said, we tie our hands together in the wampum of friendship, and we tie it by the strong cord of friendship. They said long ago it used to be a string that held us together, and this was between the Dutch and the Mohawk. Then they said our friendship is stronger than that, so we make an iron chain of friendship. Then they said iron rusts easily, and anybody can make it. So they said we cast the silver covenant chain. And that silver, we know silver will tarnish if it's not cared for. So we pledge that every year we're going to get together and polish the chain. And of course, this is a metaphor for getting together and having a council to make harmonious relations again. If anybody was murdered on either side, if anybody was cheated on either side, or any dispute, but now we call that alternative dispute resolution. But we used to actually come here and meet together face to face and talk about these belts. So they said, one more thing you promised at that time at Niagara. You said, Manda Nap Kwantaminen, and that means I give you this ship. I give you this ship, and I say it will never be empty. It'll always be full of the necessaries that you need for your life and your children's life. So that one represents the Rocket Quebec or all of North America. But what we have found out as well with these belts is that we don't actually say them in our language. In that particular speech, we never actually said that it was referring to these belts. It was just written all in Ojibwe, their understanding. So people say this is a friendship belt and it means peace and good harmony. But actually what this belt represents to us now is Aboriginal title, our Aboriginal right to hunt and fish, our nation-to-nation relationship, as well as the proper channels to deal with each other and to meet with each other. So what our chiefs had said at that time was that when Sir William Johnson, who was then the Superintendent General of Indian Affairs at that time, he had said to us, I give you this belt, I tie one end at my house and the other end with the Chippewas at Sault Ste. Marie. But then the Ojibwe chief got up and he said, this should belong at Sault Ste. Marie. It should belong in Michilimackinac, a place of more consequence for us. And then Sir William Johnson said at that time, okay, it will be entrusted to the Odawa. But over there at your house, I make a high hill. I make this high hill very high. And on top of that high hill, I place a perfectly beautiful white bird. And in our language, we say, I put there a perfectly beautiful white bird. And then at my house, Sir William Johnson had said, I make a high hill as well, a very high hill, and I put there for myself a perfectly beautiful white bird as well. And in between these two hills, I make a high road, a road that goes from that hill to the hill at my house. And anytime I have anything to say to you, I will tell my white bird. And anytime you have something to say to me, you will tell your white bird. And these are the ones that are going to talk to each other and tell each other the news. And they would say again, do not listen to bad birds. They will shake the belt. And that's what they would say at that time. So now what we say is that perfectly beautiful white bird on our end is the Odawa chief, who is the keeper of this belt. And then over on your end, what that's supposed to be, that perfectly beautiful white bird, would be who we now would call the Minister of Indian Affairs. But now we say that that's our proper channels of dealing with the settler government, is that there's a designated representative. It could be the Governor General or the Minister of Indian Affairs. And then on our end, it is the Odawa chief who's the keeper of this belt. So that's what this represents. Nation-to-nation relationship, but also the proper channels of dealing with each other. And then whenever they gave us anything in the ship from 1764 until they discontinued the presence in 1854, they gave us every year cloth for our leggings, cloth for our shirts, cloth for our skirts, blankets. They gave us net thread. They gave us cod lines, mackerel lines, and they even gave us what they call Russia and Scotch sheeting for our sails on our canoes, as well as cover our wigwams. And then, of course, they gave us tobacco. For us Anishinaabe people, we say that's the first plant that was brought here on the Turtle Island, we call them Sheikh Kamenis. The creator put that tobacco there, and he says, this is how you're going to communicate with me, as well with all the spirits that are around. And you should first offer that tobacco before you talk to us. That's what we were told. And so the Englishmen and the Frenchmen before him would always give us tobacco when they come to counsel with us. So they gave us all these macro lines, cod lines, net thread, and they gave us ammunition, ball and shot, and they gave us guns. So for 100 years they gave us this, and then in 1876 they passed the Indian Act, and then later on they passed the Game and Fisheries Act. And then they started to confiscate our nets, they started to confiscate our canoes, and they started to confiscate our catch, and then they started to tell us that we can't sell the fish, we can't sell that game. But all prior to then, we were selling it to the fort, as well as to others. We would salt the fish and sell it down to Detroit. We would make maple syrup and send it elsewhere and sell it as well. So that's what this actually represents as well. This wampum belt, it doesn't just represent friendship and harmony. But you look at it, and what the actions were done was that this actually affirms our Aboriginal right to hunt and fish, because they gave us that. By giving us that, they are acknowledging you have the right to do that. So this belt is more than a nice emblem of holding hands and walking down the road together in perfect harmony, tiptoeing through all those flowers that they said that would appear when the sun rose in the sky. That's the other thing that they used to do, and it was actually Sir William Johnson who made this belt. He either commissioned it, I don't know if he designed it, but he took a Mohawk woman, a clan mother, as his wife, or as they would say, a consort. And I believe, but I have no proof of this, that she actually was the one who designed this belt. As you look at old covenant chain belts, and I believe the Canadian Museum of Civilization has one, and there would be at either end of the belt, two men were holding up like this, and then there was a chain in between the two of them. But then as the unity got closer, that's when these two men were tied together by the closest means possible. So we have different representations of this wampum belt and this covenant chain. But historically, our wampum belts between our different nations, the Haudenosaunee gave us a belt, and we called it a dish with one spoon, and it was like a hexagon. And then they also gave us another belt. The Huron gave us another belt, and it had three diamonds in it. And in the old days, a diamond for us, before non-native people came, a diamond represented on a wampum belt, it represented a nation. And then a hexagon represented a council fire, a designated specific council fire. And then, of course, a line through the middle of a wampum belt represented a path of peace. So why I'm telling all of you this, because if you actually look, you can see it again, this path of peace. If you can see, usually they would go right down the middle of this belt, a whole path of peace. And then you see again this hexagon, and a hexagon in our old pre-colonial contact, hexagon represented a council fire, a designated place to meet. And then here, like I showed you, there's two people, the Englishmen and the Jagannath and the Anishinaabe, the Englishmen and the native person holding hands together, representing that friendship and alliance. But then when you turn this, and then you see on our end, this is how we would represent two nations bound together with those two diamonds. And that again represents how closely we were to be allied, and that they were going to look after us. So why I figure that there's two links of the chain, of course the chain links look to represent just that, chain links, but they actually also represent council fires. And for the Western Confederacy, the council fire was lit at Detroit by Sir William Johnson. And then again, it was lit at Michilimackinac. And these were two places where they were told that every summer they would come and they would get their presents. A council fire was where they would actually get their presents, as well as meet with the representatives of the Crown to discuss any issues that had come, that developed over the year. So the other place that this, for the Eastern Confederacy, would be Fort Erie and Niagara. And then this, what my going theory is, but I may be proven right or wrong, is that this last link, this fifth link of the chain, would represent Quebec or Montreal, where they would come and meet with the Governor General, and they would also be able to get presents. So when I first started reading this belt, I saw on this end that the diamonds were incomplete, and then on this side it was incomplete. And then, of course, when you look at the Western literary traditions, you read left to right. But what, and you look at any old paintings of chiefs, you'll see them hold the belts like this, and they talk about their belts. They're always holding and talking. They run their finger down as they talk. But what the Western literary tradition introduced, they introduced numerals, and they also introduced letters, and they introduced reading left to right. So here, one person had told me that I was reading this belt, and I said, well, why it's unformed or not complete at the beginning is that it recognized that there's an antecedent there. There was actually a treaty here beforehand, and now it's building on that. And then it goes through 1764, and why it is incomplete on this side, it means that it's going to keep going on into the future, that it is a promise that for eternity. But then that's when my one friend who makes these belts, his name's Ken Miracle, that's when he said one of the elders told him, put those two together, and you see that it makes a circle. And again, we look at how Anishinaabe people and Haudenosaunee people, when you hear people talk about that, they have a holistic view of the world and the universe. But what accompanies this belt is something that I don't have to show you. And it's a medal. There were 24 medals given at that time at Niagara, and the medal also served as a mnemonic device. And in fact, an Ojibwe chief from Garden River area by Sault Ste. Marie, his name is George Gebeose, he wrote that when Sir William Johnson sent his emissary over to all of us, he gave a medal. And he said, you see how that medal is round, that there's no beginning and no end. And it is the same with my promises, that my promises will be eternal, just like this circle is emblematic on this medal. So also on that medal, it has the date, 1764. And it also, after it has 1764 under it, on that medal, it has a Anishinaabe and a Jagannath sitting under a tree. And then in behind them, a fire smolders. And that's the remainder of the promises that are in that belt and on that actual, on the, when we talk about this belt, we don't actually say, the beginning lines don't say, know ye by all these presents, all the men that are gathered here today. Actually, the when we recite this belt, they actually refer to, they said that Sir William Johnson came and he says, I take a brand of the fire that I lit in the Mohawks country and I bring it here and I light up this council fire here. Not only do I light up this council fire, but I cut the choice pieces of wood, wood that will burn a clean flame and will always last forever. And I say to you, and this is what they would say, Nani John Siddiq, your fire will never go out. And I place beside that fire a poker. And if ever you think your fire is going out, stoke it. And they said also, I also provide you with a pile of wood so that you're always able to feed your fire. And I say that you and your children and your grandchildren will always be able to be come and warm themselves by this fire, and that this fire will throw off a brilliant light so that everyone will be drawn to it as like a beacon. So, and then the other thing he said, in the middle of your island, I take a tree and I erect a tree in the middle of your island. And all around this tree, I sweep around this tree, make it clear and clean. And then all around it, then I take a mat and I roll out this mat. And then that's where you and I will repose and smoke under the shade of this tree. So again, when we're talking about constitutions and we're talking about treaties and we're talking about agreements, all that I've told you about, this ship, this tree, this fire, this poker, this mat, the sun, and the flowers, that all doesn't sound like your legal agreements that you have. And if you grab it and read any of these Indian surrenders and treaties in the book that's been published, you won't see that kind of talk in there. And for us, that's how we remember this. And in fact, Sir William Johnson was the one who said, if we're going to have an effective peace, one that they will recognize, we will have to make a large wampum belt with intelligible figures thereon, because this is the way the Indians do business, and they say that they have frequent meetings to talk about their and recite the agreements that they entered into. And he says, if you don't go and recite the promises with them, they'll take it as a breach of the treaty. So what used to happen is they would come to our council fire, the designated council fire, and they'd lay these belts out. And every year before they would do this, you'll see this if you do our Kaval research, the usual ceremonies. It'll just say the usual ceremonies. But what they're actually talking about is they would get up and recite this belt, and then a representative of the crown also would have to recite what the meaning of that belt is. So our old way of doing this, they put this belt down on the middle between the two, and then the guest would come up and take the belt, and he would read the belt. And then he would set it down, and then the host would get up and read the belt and set down. And then they would say, now, how we do that now, especially in band council meetings or any corporation meetings you go to, you actually say, well, we'll read the minutes from the last meeting, and then we'll adopt the agenda, and then we'll note any amendments to those meetings, and then we'll start to conduct business anew because we're all on the same page. That's the same thing with us. When we put down this belt and the guest comes and picks it up and reads it, he's saying, this is what I remember of when we last met, and this is what we agreed to. And the same thing, he turns around and then the host reads that belt. And then that's when they both agree, okay, we're on the same page, and we're going to talk to each other and proceed from here. So the other thing that they used to do is, our elder here probably heard his elders talk about this, but this is an Anishinaabe thing that we adopted from the Haudenosaunee. When he talked about that perfectly beautiful white bird, in 1764, that was what the language that was used, and then by 1862, a treaty was effected on Manitou and Malin. And one of the founders of Confederation, William McDougall, was the commissioner of Crown Lands at that time, and he was just new to the job, and he came up to Manitou to enter into this treaty. And the Wicomicon people that were from Wicomicon, the band, they didn't want that treaty. And then one of the chiefs got up and he says, I'm so happy to see you here. He says, your ancestors spoke of a perfectly beautiful white bird, and now I have seen you come here as that perfectly beautiful white bird, and your countenance is striking. And he says, and I take a feather from this beautiful white bird, and I caress your ears so that you may hear what I have to say. And I wipe the dust from your eyes as well as any dust from your throat. I take that white feather to do that and to set everything right while you come and listen to us and we listen to you. So when I'm reading the text of that treaty, the proceedings of that treaty, I can just imagine William McDougall, who's come from Prince Edward Island, he's like, what the hell are these Indians talking about? So, me gwechgibiz in the mekkeni enchiek chinen dam dashgibiz aya mam pe monyang mino adash me gwech the me gwech ma ba mali ki chen nakki nakkit mino adash ki and so bebejik give zage eok that all of you, I'm happy that all of you have come out tonight to come and listen to Aaron and myself and then our elder up there as well. Sunny Diabo. Miigwech.
Hello, all my relations. I'm very grateful to be here this evening. I'm grateful for the introduction, grateful for our elder, Sonny Diabo, starting us in a good way. And I think by the end, it'll be even clearer why I'm grateful, not just that he did that, but for specifically the message he shared. I'm grateful that ALSA decided to do this. When I was in law school, we didn't do anything this cool, so kudos for that, and Molly for being so wonderful in helping. I got to apologize up front. I'm going to run a little bit long, and so the pacing is quicker than usual. But questions are really important to me, so if it does push a little bit late, I'm willing to stay a little later, and I hope we can really engage with one another. I want to use our time to build on the foundation Al laid in two ways. First, I want to articulate the Treaty of Niagara as an expression of Anishinaabe constitutionalism. And second, I want to connect the historical significance of that understanding to our lives today as citizens of a shared political community 250 years later. I'm going to argue that understanding the Treaty of Niagara through the lens of Anishinaabe constitutionalism discloses Indigenous legal traditions as both the means and ends of decolonizing our relationships today. Thus, through the journey, though the journey may seem to take us some distance away from the topic tonight, by the end, I hope we'll have made plain just how central understanding Indigenous legal traditions are to understanding Niagara then and now. From having listened to Al, it sounds to me like we both want to argue that since the Treaty of Niagara established a framework for Indigenous settler relations, it is, in a very real sense, the Treaty of Treaties. But what does that mean? What is a treaty? Is it a contract? Is it a sacred covenant, perhaps with Creator as a third party? Are so-called Indian treaties akin to treaties formed under public international law today? Is a treaty a constitutional document, a land transfer? Maybe the answer is that treaties are an important source of rights for Indigenous peoples, but are irrelevant to the constitution of political community, because as then Chief Justice Lemaire bluntly stated in the Delgamuukw decision, let us face it, we are all here to stay. Well, I want to start with the view from Canadian constitutionalism, since for many of us, that will be the most accessible. The Supreme Court of Canada imagines that treaties are contracts, albeit subject to particular interpretive principles. It offered four such principles in the Badger case and expanded this list to nine in Marshall No. 1. The first principle offered in Badger sets out contract as the conceptual framework for treaty. First, the court wrote, it must be remembered that a treaty represents an exchange of solemn promises between the Crown and the various Indian nations. It is an agreement whose nature is sacred. Now, that sounds an awful lot like contract, except for the sacred bit. Presumably, that's intended to signal the importance of these special contracts. But the exchange of solemn promises is a pretty thin notion of the sacred, because just about all of the common law of contract can pass through it. The Supreme Court has read treaties as contracts many times, describing them as written documents, saying that treaty rights are those contained in official agreements, and most explicitly writing that treaties are analogous to contracts, albeit of a very solemn and special public nature. Whatever that means, these statements are all from Badger. The Marshall case adds that the goal of treaty implementation is to choose from among the various possible interpretations of common intention, the one which best reconciles the interests of both the parties at the time the treaty was signed. In analogizing to contract, the court is seeking certainty. So too is the Crown. It openly calls modern treaties comprehensive land claims agreements and says that they're intended to, quote, establish certainty of ownership and control of lands and resources and encourage economic activity. This straight from the Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada website. The reading of treaty as contract has as its end the promotion of negative liberty, that is, one's freedom from interference of others, certainty, specifically with respect to one's property interests in land. Well, what about the Indigenous peoples of Turtle Island? What does the contract vision of treaty have to say about us? The Supreme Court said just this summer in the Chilcotin Nation decision that, quote, throughout most of Canada, the Crown entered into treaties whereby the Indigenous peoples gave up their claim to land in exchange for reservations and other promises, which presumably are the enumerated provisions of the Crown's written renderings of treaty. Well, I'd be truly fascinated to hear the Supreme Court of Canada articulate the Treaty of Niagara in this way. How does it play out on the contract story? How do we parse the covenant chain into promises taking the form of actionable rights? What remedy for breach? What does the 24 Nations Belt, how would it be read? And what about friendship? That seems to be the most central promise the Anishinaabe bargained for. How does friendship translate into rights discourse? Can an autonomous agent contract his or her friendship out and remain an autonomous agent? Or is that like contracting out loyalty, which would seem to violate the primacy of individual autonomy and hence be internally incoherent? Posing these questions without attempting answers is actually the most charitable account I can offer of contract as a lens of reading the Treaty of Niagara, because to my mind, it's impossible to reconcile the actual statements and actions of the Niagara Congress with the conceptual boundaries of contract. I see only incoherence and it hurts my head. And having begun my discussion this way, I've tried to emphasize that how we answer the question, what is treaty, turns on how we think about law. I've suggested, I think uncontroversially, that Canadian law is centered on individual autonomy, that is, on disconnected selves, and hold that thought. Because individual liberty is taken as the primary political good, Canada's system of law is deontological, that is, duty-based. To ensure that individual autonomy stays up front, we need the certainty of normative ordering that reciprocal rights and duties are said to offer. On this account of treaty, there are party-differentiated rights obtained through contract that attach to individual members of the parties. Now, I want to leave Canadian law behind and share with you my understanding of Anishinaabe law, and specifically Anishinaabe constitutionalism. It's just my understanding, so please don't take it as louder than my voice. And after that, I want to read it, what Al explained to us against it, and see if it might make more sense than the contract story. Well, 3 months ago, I was visiting Milkamis, my grandmother, Bessie Mainville of Pootaching First Nation, at her home on Rainy Lake in northwestern Ontario. And sitting on her back porch, she turned the small white cloth tobacco bundle I gave her over in her fingers as she thought. She wanted to talk that day about law and governance. And when she began to speak, her words are about seasons of a human life. She talks about birthing, youth, adulthood, and death. She talks about transitions between each season and learning how to be towards oneself and others during them. She talks about the responsibilities community members have to help out. She shares with me the practices of being, and she explains that these are laws. She underscores the enormity of their impact on her life and the effect they have on who she is even today. She impresses on my eager mind how vital it is to mark the boundaries of changing life with ceremony. She's careful to ensure I understand what's lost without Anishinaabemowin, the Ojibwe language. And she explains that every step of life is important because what we're talking about with law and governance is a way of life. It took me 2 years to realize that Nokomis hadn't misunderstood my question, that in the many moments like this one, she had in fact been sharing law. Trained in law school to conflate Canada's conception of law with the concept of law, it took me 2 years of total confusion to decolonize that part of my mind, just to be able to hear the teachings shared. For as you will have gathered, Nokomis's conception of law is profoundly non-deontological, that is, not duty rights centered. For her, law is a way of life, how to be, the practices of the self. So you won't ever hear my grandmother talk about rights, autonomy, or justice. Within Anishinaabemowin, there's no concept corresponding to law, as we mean that term, within liberal constitutional orders, like Canada's. There's no independent formal sphere of action putatively set apart from moral, political, social, economic, spiritual, or ecological social interaction, sorry, human interaction. There's no myth of a social order sustained by impartial rules and disinterested arbiters of them. Instead, normative ordering arises through many different concepts which cut across multiple social spheres at once. Law is part of what Marcel Mauss famously called a total social fact. And this is how she teaches me. She gives me the words. Today I want to talk about two of them that have everything to do with Anishinaabe constitutionalism and everything to do with the Treaty of Niagara. The first one we've already begun to engage, Menetholkeawin, which means to make from spirit. And I've come to understand it as the personal practice of acknowledgement and communication with the spiritual, drawing on one's own spiritual self to do so. But the spiritual is everywhere all of the time, in and around us, in all our relations. Menetholkeawin then points to a way of being in which one's recognition of connection through spirit to all others animates his or her orientation towards them. And this is not spirit in the sense of the spirit of God or the supernatural sense of those who have gone on. This is spirit in the sense of medicine power, which is in each of us here today. It reflects a medicine wheel teaching that is whole selves. We consist of body, mind, feeling, and spirit, and that reason is not a faculty over which the mind has dominion. It's a verb that we exercise through all four aspects of our whole self. And Menetholkeawin is about constituting ourselves in the world, being and reasoning with others as spiritual subjectivities. The concept and practice of Menetholkeawin discloses the deep relationality at the heart of Anishinaabe constitutionalism. The thing we're making by connecting to one another is healthy relationships, where our interconnections openly acknowledged and communicated. This turns us towards the second word I wanted to share, and this one came to me from Andy Skye of Eagle Lake, who does a lot of work with elders in Treaty 3 on law and governance. The word is Kakino Kage Napsin. Kakino Kego Napsin. Everything is interconnected and part of the land, and thus we must live in harmony with the natural world and maintain balance in order to have a good life. Everything and everyone belongs to the land and has a purpose and a gift to sustain life for now and in the future. Well, the gift element is absolutely critical because it moves us beyond the ontological claim of foundational interconnection to foundational interdependence. All of us, each member of each order of creation, the birds, animals, crawlers, swimmers, plant peoples, lakes and mountains, and us, the two-legged, we're inescapably constitutive of one another because we have need of one another's gifts in order to be our fullest selves and with respect to some of our most proximate relations, sometimes just to survive. I am through all my relations, and so for each of us, including non-humans. These two concepts, Menetholkeawin and Kakanakegonapsin, come together in a specially powerful way when we make the move from Anishinaabe law to Anishinaabe constitutionalism. And in using that word, I don't have in mind the unwritten conventions of the UK or the written constitutions so invoked today, even though some Anishinaabe communities have turned to them. I have in mind our story of the constitution of political community, and that doesn't have to begin with an abstract statement of principle. In fact, I'd offer that none can, and that those which appear to do so are actually leaving much undisclosed. For us, as for all peoples, our political community is a product of our origin story. Only ours is not a story of transplantation. We have not migrated to Turtle Island in an effort either to avoid religious persecution or to extend the power base of a distant empire. We are indigenous to this land, and as such, the story we tell of our beginning speaks of its creation. I can't share this story today, but I can summarize where it leaves us. The Odzokonan are our sacred stories. Nanabojo, a part human, part Menado spirit transformer, is a protagonist in many of them. and his actions led to the flooding of the world. And he found himself on a raft on a turtle's back, floating in a world lost to water. The recreation of the world was contingent on the mutual commitment of each kind of being within it to share its unique gift with all others. Earth would not have been created had not the turtle risen, the divers dived, the thunderers secured the ocean surface from the water Manitouk below, the sun shone, the four winds blown, the four leggeds walked, the flyers flown, the earth dried and supported new life, and the two-legged, here Nanabojo, us, accepted his responsibility as part of and not other than the rest of his relations, and thus sought to realize his vision with them. Each of us has a unique gift that all of us need to survive. Each kind of being serves as the ongoing condition of the possibility of all others. Not one of us exists autonomously, although we are uniquely located within our shared relational web. So that speaks to the gift aspect of Kakinake Gonap Sin, but the definition earlier spoke also of harmony, and we heard that too from Al. From an Anishinaabe perspective, though, harmony is not romantic. It has nothing to do with an imagined post-conflict political community. Such a thing never has, will, or should exist. Rather, it refers to the tension sustained between citizens of a shared political community under relations of interdependence. And that actually necessitates conflict. I want to consider how some of the greats have engaged with teaching, this teaching about harmony as interdependence. Elder and formal Royal Ontario Museum curator Basil Johnston put the point this way. There are four orders in creation. First is the physical world, second the plant world, third the animal, and last the human world. All four parts are so intertwined that they make up life and whole existence. With less than the four orders, life and being are incomplete and unintelligible. No one portion is self-sufficient or complete. Rather, each derives its meaning from and fulfills its function and purpose within the context of the whole creation. Elder Art Solomon shared a similar teaching. He says, "It has always been clear in our minds that the natural things around us also had their own part in the ongoing creation, their own original instructions. The plant life, water life, animal life, bird life, our mother earth, our grandfather moon, our elder brother sun, the star world, all these had followed their own original instructions, which is to say, they provided their unique gifts to creation." The Reverend Dr. Stanley McKay, former moderator of the United Church of Canada and citizen of the Fisher River Cree Nation, shares a teaching in which he speaks generally about Indigenous peoples, but which I adopt as representative of Anishinaabe Lawways. And he says, "Indigenous spirituality from around the world is centered on the notion of our relationship to the whole creation. We call the earth our mother. The animals are our brothers and sisters. Even what biologists describe as inanimate, we call our relatives. The calling of creation into our community is a metaphorical construction that describes the relationship of love and faithfulness between people and creation. Our identity as creatures in the creation cannot be expressed without talking about the rest of creation, since that very identity includes a sense of the interdependence and connectedness of all life." Well, we should note the scope of what this entails for Anishinaabe legal theory vis-a-vis Canadian constitutionalism. The interdependence view of harmony replaces justice, both as the ultimate goal of normative ordering and as the organizing principle of political community. Deontology is thus not just reduced to one small voice amongst others, rather recognizing that it knows only how to scream, that it can't play well with others, that standing on principle it doesn't try to, and that since its sole concern is with being right, it has no interest in harmony, it's denied entrance into the community. Elder lawyer and scholar Sock H. Henderson ties all of this together when he says, "Most Aboriginal orders do not impose order on relationships by establishing rules that govern general categories of acts and persons, and then using these rules to decide particular disputes. Instead, they determine that harmony, trust, sharing, and kindness are the shared ends of the circle of life, and then make choices that contribute to these goals. All my relations to live well together, we don't need an overlapping consensus and we don't need contract, although we can settle for it. To the extent that all of us are to flourish, it will be that because of our respective acknowledgments of Kakinatke Go-Nafsin and our practices of Manitokewin, we're oriented in right relation towards one another. Treaty then is simply the exercise of these acknowledgments and practices between peoples. It is the fundament of Anishinaabe legal order deployed as the framework for constituting a relationship between groups, which is to say, treaties constitute political community. So now, I want to use this Anishinaabe legal framework as a lens through which to explore the Treaty of Niagara. Approaching the evidentiary record from the perspective of Anishinaabe constitutionalism, we could consider so much, but I have time only to focus on wampum belts. Well, devout contractarians may try to torture reciprocal rights and duties out of them, but for those of us willing to situate them within their own cultural logic, I suspect we'll find tremendous resonance with the view from harmony as interdependence. Al informed us earlier that a wampum belt is the physical embodiment of a treaty relationship, and their materiality is a wonderful reminder of what treaty means, the living terms upon which a relationship exists. Like the relationships they represent, wampum belts are never static. They change and grow old with time. They need ongoing care, or else strands can break, beads can be lost, sections can warp, stretch, or stain, and the images woven, if not frequently enough reinvigorated with new life, can be covered in dust, unrecognizable. In the worst scenario, a relationship might go untended altogether, and the bonds which constituted it simply dissolve. Of course, the temporality of wampum belts mirrors real life. Sometimes, events call us into new relationships. An old belt has served its purpose, it becomes necessary to let it rest, return it to Earth, and bring a new one into being. As Al explained, a major shift in relations is exactly what happened at Niagara. Britain sought to bring New France's former allies into the covenant chain, its relationship with the Haudenosaunee. Dozens of wampum belts were exchanged, but most significant are these two. And for two reasons. First, together they represent the heart of the treaty. And second, both of them traveled from the British to the Anishinaabe, which is to say Sir William Johnson very well understood the significance of wampum and the results it yielded, and thus knowingly participated in Anishinaabe law, even if he failed to fully apprehend its logic. Writing to General Gage in February of 1764, planning the summer congress at Niagara, he wrote, "At this treaty wheresoever held, we should tie them down in the peace, according to their own forms of which they take the most notice," that is, he recognizes wampum as an indigenous diplomatic institution, "for example, by exchanging a very large belt with some remarkable and intelligible figures thereon, expressive of the occasion, images woven into the belt, embodying the understanding achieved and intended to serve as mnemonic devices." And then he says, "which should always be shown at public meetings to remind them of their promises, that is, renewal and ongoing mutual recognition." Johnson's speech accompanying the actual gifting of the 1764 Covenant Chain Belt invokes the same deep relational understanding. He says, "Brothers of the Western nations, sachems, chiefs, and warriors, you have now been here for several days, during which time we have frequently met to renew and strengthen our engagements, and you have made so many promises of your friendship and attachment to the English that there now only remains for us to exchange the great belt of the Covenant Chain, that we may not forget our mutual engagements." And when he finished the speech and gave the belt, an Anishinaabe Ogema leader arose and said, "Brother, I am of the opinion that it is best to keep the belt of the Covenant Chain at Michilimackinac, as it is the center where all our people may see it. I exhort you to hold fast by it, to remember what has been said, and to abide by your engagements. That is, we'll see whether the snapshot promises you put to paper are borne out. Everything turns on our practices of being together, Manitokewin. And the connection through spirit here is enormous. In 1764, Michilimackinac was not only the center of Anishinaabe territory, it is also the center of creation. Michilimackinac means great turtle because it's the spot where, on the Anishinaabe view, creation was reborn on a turtle's back. It's the center of creation that the Anishinaabe chose to care for our relationship. If the 1764 Covenant Chain Belts represents Manitokewin, the 24 Nation Belts represents Kakinok, Kigo-Napsin. It is the very image of interconnection. 24 figures holding hands, connecting a British boat to Anishinaabe land. And the shared understanding it reveals is that our interconnection is to be sustained through gifts that meet our need. We'll flash forward, reminding the British of their Treaty of Niagara commitment. Almost 90 years later, Ogimaa-Sikinak drew from the oral tradition the British commitment. And he said, "My children see, this is my canoe floating on the other side of the great waters. It shall never be exhausted, but always full of the necessaries of life for you, my children, as long as the world shall last. Should it happen any time after this that you find the strength of your life reduced, you Indian tribes must take hold of the vessel and pull. It shall be in your power to pull towards you this my canoe. And when you have brought it over to this land on which you stand, I will open my hand, as it were, and you will find yourselves supplied with plenty." Well, this is an explicit acknowledgement of our interdependence through gift. Our mutual practices of being together have also echoed forward through the years. 72 years after the Niagara Congress, we can see the crown still identified, that the significance of Wampum Belt Protocol lies in the relational bond it establishes, which allows for exchange, and not the voluntary obligation to exchange anything in particular. Sir Francis Bonhead, Lieutenant Governor of Upper Canada, wrote in 1836 to Lord Glenelg, Colonial Secretary, from Manitoulin Island, where a new treaty was being signed, and the Treaty of Niagara was invoked in the process. He expressed his understanding of the Wampum institution like so. "Whenever the belt is produced, every minute circumstance which attended its delivery seems instantly to be brought to life. And such is the singular effect produced on the Indian's mind by this talisman that it is common for him who we term the savage to shed tears at the sight of a wampum which has accompanied a message from his friend." Folks, there must be an awfully powerful promise in a contract like that. So, that's all fine and good, but we might ask, what does it have to do with today? And probably unsurprisingly, my answer is everything. Why do we have Indigenous economic underdevelopment on a national scale? Why 1,200 missing and murdered Indigenous women? Why Lubicon Cree? Why Grassy Narrows, Anishinaabe? Why Algonquins of Barrier Lake? Why Iprawash, Wyoka? Why Cindy Blackstock made an enemy of the state? Why Jordan's principle? Why more children in care now than at the height of the 60s scoop? Why among the highest youth suicide rates on the planet? Why extinguishment clauses become certainty clauses? Why I don't know more? Why Niagara, 1764? Colonialism is, was, and until defeated, will always be a mode of relation between a hegemonic imperial power and Indigenous peoples already present, already organized in political communities. Settlement and displacement is but one phase of this relation, which is throughout all phases fundamentally committed to violence, often initially physical, always eventually structural, always eventually epistemic. The relation has not changed. It is the need to sustain for settlers the benefit of their privilege, which, unattached to any sense of reciprocal relationship, they've simply, many of them, not all, come to expect, which motivates Canada to sustain a colonial relationship with Indigenous peoples today. It is through their expectation of continued settler privilege that Canadians today, who rightly disclaim any connection to the earlier settlement and displacement phase of colonialism, have become direct causal agents of colonialism now. Although the legal status of Indigenous legal persons and communities has shifted under Canadian law, the colonial mode of relation has survived all legal changes of season, harmony squeezed out of the crushing grip of social contract. And so, we're in conflict. In his work on Indigenous settler reconciliation, Anishinaabe elder Fred Kelly of the Ojibwas of Onigamekw Treaty 3 shares this insight, connecting right back to what we said earlier about Anishinaabe legal theory. And he says, "While international conflicts are fought between enemies on a very clear and simple proposition of win or lose. The choice here in Canada is one that must be made among friends and neighbors. We must face the underlying tensions, we must understand them, and we must resolve them. Neither side believes that the other is going anywhere. This is home. So how do we live side by side and build a future of prosperity together? We share space in the common land. We constitute a society that is envied by other countries. We're economically interdependent. We have many social ties. Our children are married to one another, and through which we share generations of grandchildren. So inextricably tied are we that our options are also very clear and simple. We can all win, or we can all lose. Well, so if the answer isn't either settlers go home or Indigenous peoples assimilate, what is to be done? In his retirement speech, Chief Justice Finch of the British Columbia Court of Appeal, as he then was, suggested a dramatic shift in perspective amongst Canadian legal actors. He said, "I suggest the current Canadian legal system must reconcile itself to coexistence with pre-existing Indigenous legal orders. This conference," that was the context for his comments, "poses the question, how can we make space within the legal landscape for Indigenous legal orders? The answer depends, at least in part, on an inversion of the question. A crucial part of this process must be to find space for ourselves as strangers and newcomers within the Indigenous legal orders themselves." Not bad, Justice Finch, but not trailblazing either, because we already got there 250 years ago this summer. Why Niagara 1764? Because finding space for strangers within Indigenous legal orders is exactly what transpired, and as a result, everyone's presence here was legitimate. Why Niagara 1764? Because it preempts the white supremacy of the Confederation constitutional story and offers us a better one. Indigenous peoples were not part of Confederation. We are not subjects of popular sovereignty. I am not party to the contract. Niagara is the story of political community constituted on non-domination, on a fundamental commitment to mutual recognition and our interdependence. Why Niagara 1764? Because it's our shared constitution. And as citizens of a shared political community, we ought to say, I'm Indigenous, I'm a settler, I'm both. On this one point, it doesn't matter, because no matter where I'm located within it, this is my community. That's why I put the tobacco down. This is my community, and domination will not serve as its foundation. We need each other. We need to learn from each other. Unless you're like Jeffrey Simpson, because he's so good at being right that apparently he doesn't need to consider the possibility there might be something he doesn't understand, something he needs others to help him with. Either he knows he's always right in advance and so doesn't need to apprehend the logic behind the aspirations and political projects of Indigenous peoples, or he's such an expert on us that he doesn't need us to speak, because if you listen to him tell it, either way, he knows what's best for us. So let's take him as a case study of knowing the other before being in relationship with it. From his writing, you'll discover that people who suffer from being this right have a great deal of privilege. For instance, they get to gleefully identify the chasm between Indigenous peoples' aspirations for healthy communities and their colonial reality. They can even sneer that the undying aspiration is hard to stomach. I mean, you can't make this up. They can use brackets to talk about Indigenous peoples' self-description as nations and non-Indigenous peoples as settlers to rhetorically deny any air of reality to the colonial mode of our relationship. And they can impute causation for any mode of Indigenous resistance to a racialized psychological gap between dream and reality. He actually calls anti-colonialism, his word, dreamy and even flamboyant. Given my setup, his answer to everything is exactly what you would expect. Let's call it the contract fallacy. The only indigenous peoples he writes positively about are those involved in neoliberal economic development schemes because, quote, these communities have decided collectively to integrate to varying degrees with the majority cultures. That is, they've signed on. He concludes his piece voicing his utter contempt for our belief in our capacity to constitute healthy political communities, saying, and I quote, to imagine that isolated communities of 1,000 or so people can be vibrant and self-sustaining, capable of discharging the panoply of responsibilities of sovereignty, is to live within the dream palace of memory. Well, I had the very good fortune of working with Paul Kahn during my time at Yale Law School, and he writes of intercultural judgment that every criticism is thought to rest on a particular community's values. There's no way to make cross-cultural comparisons of value. To condemn another's practices is simply to produce a kind of tautological affirmation of one's own values. All my relations, if someone doesn't understand that, then they're living in a dream palace because they're so caked in privilege, they can no longer see the difference between their view and the view. And if it sounds like someone you know, that person needs your help because at least one thing they've lost is humility, and nobody can be in right relationship without that. Tonight I've tried to share a vision of treaty that pushes back on the contract story. I've shared my understanding that within Anishinaabe legal order, treaty is simply the extension of the heart of what our law is all about. Harmony is interdependence, Meneto Kewin, and Kakina Kego Nafsin, to the case of intersocietal relations. Treaties are neither, they're not contracts, they're the total relational means by which we orient and reorient ourselves to one another through time, to live well together, and with all our relations within creation. And as such, they're at the heart of citizenship on Turtle Island. So, what can we do? How do we decolonize indigenous settler relationships today? Well, that's a big question. And I've been trying to voice one answer all the way through my remarks. If treaty is a relationship, not a contract, then we have only to practice it. And the crown is not part of creation. It's not involved with even one soul in a relation of interdependence. It's without spirit and is not capable of Manitou Kewin. We ought not to hold our breath for it to take action. It falls to us, citizens of a shared political community. We're the ones connected, the ones in need. So about that, I want to close with a bit of a bait and switch. In another life, I worked at the Competition Bureau, so I know how that's done. And you were led to believe you were attending a free lecture this evening. In fact, for some of you, the freeness of the information shared might have been a necessary condition of your attending. Your time is valuable, and if you had to pay to be here, you could be elsewhere instead. So, but here you are. Why? What are we doing here? We're sitting there, you're sitting there listening, we're here talking. Well, having been raised in a liberal constitutional order, I'm told it's a free country, and you can exercise your individual autonomy, decide for yourself what you are doing here tonight in this moment. If you're party to a contract, an essential term of which is freeness, then this lecture is a free event, and you won't hear me argue. But I want to share, I'm not here tonight as party to a contract, and it hasn't been free for me. My flight and hotel were covered, that's not what I mean. But I mean, when I was asked to come, I knew I'd be receiving the gift of your time. It is a gift. That's you to me right now, gift. You could be anywhere else. I mean, this is Montreal. But here you are. Here we are. And in preparing myself to receive your gift in a good way, I asked myself, what are the gifts I carry, and what do I need to share tonight? So I answered the question, what am I doing here, with a very different logic. We're being with one another and it's an act of creation. We've entered into a relationship because we need one another. We have the information you need, maybe to be stimulated, maybe to prepare for what you fear will be a difficult exam question. Maybe, if we're lucky, you're here because you need tools to empower you to assert a more robust sense of citizenship in Canada today. I'm here. I came needing help affecting the colossal social shift I seek in decolonizing the structural conditions of all of our lives, Indigenous and other, and in creating the foundation for healthy citizenship in our shared political community, a citizenship that finds its origins in the Indigenous legal orders that justify all of our presences here today. So, all my relations, thank you for the gift of your time. Thank you for coming and bringing your need. I hope not to have disappointed. And now, either the terms are fully executed or the relationship continues. I wonder if you two have received a gift this evening, and if so, what responsibility do you carry? Thank you very much. That's all I have to say.
Thank you for two very thought-provoking and heartfelt presentations. And I know they've generated in each of us a lot of questions and thinking, and some of those questions you may not quite be ready to ask just yet, but for some of you, you might have questions already in your mind. So I'm wondering, I think we have time. It is, we do have a reception following this event, which you're all invited to, and during the reception, there'll be time for continued discussion and dialogue. However, we do have time, I believe, my directions from Molly here, for a couple of questions. So if you can go to the microphone and identify yourself and ask your question briefly, and our speakers have are willing to answer questions.
Thanks for coming. My question is about the way that you're describing treaties as a relationship. And it's my understanding that the settler governments view land cession treaties as essentially Aboriginal groups giving up their Aboriginal right. And do you think that, or I guess what are your thoughts if we view treaties more as a relationship? Do you think that could mean that land cession treaties don't necessarily mean that all Aboriginal title has been given up? I guess just in a shorter version, do you think that it's possible to, given that treaties are relationships, do you think that it's possible to reevaluate cessions that were made, rights that were agreed on? Or how do you view the evolution of treaty relationships?
Thanks for your question. I don't think we've got a bead on any of those treaties. I mean, I think because of Manitoukewin, I'm in the treaties are sacred camp. I think the reading we've given of almost all of them under Canadian law, giving them constitutional expression as rights, is to fundamentally misunderstand them. So, if the question is about the distribution of rights, I want to call all of it into question. And in terms of Aboriginal title, this is like the ultimate colonial irony. It's only when Indigenous peoples are forced to express their political claims, their self-understandings within the discourse of a colonial government that the reality, the great settler fear of reversion, right, that title could flip, is even possible within the logic of our own legal systems, which are relationship-centered, where even as I bring forward a claim, I'm always considering the other. That's not possible, right? Because it would be a necessary condition of seeking that sort of result is you begin by disregarding the interests of the other. You say, all mine, not yours, and that logic just doesn't compute. If we start from the understanding that we're actually all interdependent, not that we're actually all autonomous, disconnected selves.
But we, for the island here, Manitoulin, we looked at this one as a living treaty, and when you talk about it as a relationship, what it encourages to do is to read the actual proceedings of the treaty, and then not just the text, and then read afterward the petitions where they say, this wasn't what was agreed to, this wasn't what was agreed to. You never brought this up, and ours, on Manitoulin area, you have all these, what we call the island claims now, but all throughout, in both treaties that were in our area, Robinson Huron 1850, and then also the Manitoulin of 1862, they deliberately inserted in the English text and the surrounding islands. But immediately after both treaties, the chief said, you never talked about the islands. We consider them as not being sold. So you look at the petitions afterward, they discontinued the presence in 1854. They continued to give blankets. But what they wrote a petition to the Governor General again, they said, we have the belts in front of us in our assembly, and we have all smoked the pipe amongst ourselves, and we invite you to come and do the same so that we may renew this sacred friendship. And we have the idea that this friendship that was once so sacred isn't held so sacred by you anymore. But we hope that we will be able to go and explain in Ottawa what these treaties mean. And failing that, we would then like to go to talk to the Queen and express what these treaties are. So they had a 1764, and it was repledged again. I didn't bother bringing the other belt that was repledged in 1786 after the American Revolution. And then the other thing that when we talk about a living treaty and a relationship treaty, what I didn't get to talk about here, like I talk a long time about these things, but what ends up happening is one belt is given and then another belt is given, and it strengthens those belts. And it's about a relationship. The 1786 belt strengthens this one. It doesn't abrogate, derogate, or supplant this belt. This is the foundational belt. And then even during the War of 1812, they sent a delegate out, Robert Dixon, and they wrote a speech, and each time they had this speech read, there was a deliberate line in there that said, I remember the belt that Sir William Johnson had given you, and I know that it is still amongst you, and I give this belt only to strengthen that belt, and we want you to come and fight with us against the Americans. And then, of course, the other belt that was given was by Lieutenant Governor Simcoe, so Lieutenant Governor Simcoe as well, and then the Rottenberg. So each time, these belts were actually looked at as living treaties, what we call living treaties, and the relationship didn't actually end until they started what you referred to, these treaties that were actually about extinguishment and trades of particular parcels of land. But up to 1881, the chiefs in our area had these belts out, and they were actually told that they were going to be prevented from going to England to visit the Queen. They said, you will not get an audience if you go there. And then, ironically, what happened in 1982, when they were trying to repatriate the Constitution, they took these replica belts to England. And it was the Grand Chief of the Union of Ontario Indians at the time, his name was Pat Madhavi. And when he went over there to take these belts there, of course, he didn't get an audience. And then he came back to Canada, and he tried to use a Anishinaabe passport, and they wouldn't let him back into Canada. So that's the other thing, is that we use these belts not just as heirlooms. They're actually a living treaty, and they're about the relationship as well. When we talk about this relationship, the one belt that, when Aaron was talking about referring to the one speech that Sir William Johnson, when he actually gave the belt, he said, brethren. And that was how we dealt with it at that point in time. We were calling each other brothers. And then after we took this belt, Sir William Johnson then said, I will send another belt to your country, and then we will go through the adoption process. And then that's when we called them father, and they called us children. But it was a specific another part of the agreement to actually get that going as well. And the last thing, though, one of the elders who just passed away about 10 years ago, he used to say to us, if the king's a great father and or the queen's a great mother and we're all the red children, then this is the biggest case of child abuse in history. That was Ernie DeBosque, late Ernie DeBosque.
You actually may have answered my question. My question is, both of you speak of the Treaty of Niagara, and you speak as if your people and the English both came to that treaty with good faith. But that both the Aboriginal people and the English came to that treaty in good faith. That seems to be what you're saying. It's not clear to me, if you do, if that is what you believe, it's not clear to me, when did the shift change from the colonizers? When did they stop acting in good faith? And was there a particular person responsible, a particular law responsible, whatever?
Just before you answer, I'm wondering if we could have the last question as well. And then, because I'm noticing a few people have to leave, I think it was supposed to end at around 7, but I want people to come to the reception. So perhaps we could have this last question, and then our panelists can respond. Yes.
Hi.
Short answer, it actually began when they gave us this.
Oh. Well, I'm eager to hear that story. Thank you for coming. My question is in particular for you. I was struck when you said that you had to decolonize your brain when you got out of law school. What would you say was a specific part of law school that colonized your brain? And is there a way for us, as we're here, to try to start a bit of that work? Thanks.
The first point I actually want to, sorry, where's the first guy? Great. I just want to make a comment about the language of the colonizer, and I used quite liberally throughout my piece the language of the settler. And I have some discomfort with these words. It's been a real struggle with myself about how I want to talk about this. I mean, in a relational understanding, that kind of matters, right? And so the way I made my peace with it is to say, I really truly believe that through Indigenous law and what we're talking about, the Treaty of Niagara in particular, everyone's presence here is legitimate. So I don't use the term settler in a way that's intended to deny a kind of a citizenship, a critical political status legitimacy to non-Indigenous peoples. So I just want to be really clear about that. It goes to knowing our own stories. And so I think although settler presence is legitimate here, part of having a healthy relationship, people of settler ancestry, and I'm included, we have to own our arrival stories. That has to be part. Otherwise, it's pretty hard to take on the question of settler privilege. Okay. I don't think there is a sort of magic moment where everything turned, but I do think the War of 1812 was pretty critical, and after that, British policy changed very quickly towards Indigenous peoples. And so we start to see some of the really offensive legal doctrines starting not immediately after, but not too long after. And of course, the result of the war was a massive shift in power and military power, and Indigenous peoples were no longer necessary to Britain in the same way. But all of which just begs the question about intentionality. One of the things I've heard, and I actually need to research this more because I just don't know, is that the Home Office didn't actually have near the depth of understanding that Johnston did on the ground. And so maybe the understanding didn't translate back home a long ways back. It's a fantastic question. It's a really important one for the work I do, and I just haven't looked into it yet. The other question, well, my starting point is it's hard to answer because the teachings I have are I'm only supposed to speak for myself. But I do feel that most of us are colonized, not just indigenous peoples. We're all affected by the relational dynamic that obtains between us. I don't mean it in an offensive way. I mean we're living within a structure of power, whether we want to or not. So for myself, I'm not sure how far the video will go, so I have to be careful about that too. I took a huge amount of value from my education at U of T Law, but it was a very liberal education. The legal theory there, or dominant there, was very different from, I should say, when I was going through. It may have changed dramatically already since, but was very different from the kind of theory that I'm interested in. And so what I didn't always get was a deep contextual analysis of how law works power. And there are professors who are absolutely wonderful. You know, I took a course with Jenny Nadelsky, amazing. But that wasn't always the case. And so I really struggled a lot. And my reaction to Canadian law was sort of overwhelming. And law generally, that was my point, right? I mean, I mistook it for the concept of law, not just one law way, if you will. One of my supervisors, Jim Tully, has a strategy for this, and it involves entering into a dialogue with differently situated people, because when you do that, inadvertently, you see a mirror of yourself. And so it's a powerful way of coming to understand the way that your own ways have been constructed. So making a point of engaging with other systems. I would expect this problem doesn't exist at McGill because of the trans-systemic pedagogy. Doesn't exist in the same way at McGill because of... but engaging with a different system of law, it throws into relief the one that you're already immersed in, because often its structures are invisible to us.
Okay, thank you for those questions and for the answers. And I wanted to, as a final part of the evening, call upon Molly Churchill and Alan Vicker from the SEED office to say a word of thanks. So,
I don't really have words of thanks formed at this point, so just very deep thank you for my part, and I think I can probably speak on behalf of most of the people in this room, and thanking you both very much for coming, sharing your knowledge and your ideas and your visions with us. It's very much appreciated. Thank you. I'm learning that perhaps we were doing this backwards, but we have an offering of tobacco and as well as some sweet grass to thank you both, and Elder Alex Sunny Daibo as well. So just in exchange for all the knowledge you've shared with us as well, thank you for that.
I just want to acknowledge how grateful I am for that, and that frankly, it doesn't matter that you're doing it backwards. everything turns right on the kind of the intention, the effort, the kind of relationship that this brings us into. So, Gitemigwit.
Thank you for coming. And there is a reception in the atrium. Merci beaucoup d'être venu. Et il y a une réception dans l'atrium. Merci.